Good morning. Our committee will come to order on Committee on Commerce and Consumer Protection, Tuesday, February 1st, 2011. Good morning, everyone. I know that things are already starting to heat up schedule-wise. I've heard from a number of members that are pulled in different directions and will probably be coming and going. I've got a couple of announcements before we get started on today's overviews and agenda. The first item is there's some additional information in your packets that we have requested or people have offered up as we've done some of these other overviews. And first, we have everybody has a green folder. This was provided by the Department of Commerce. And this is this whole packet. I think it's on a number of different things, but it's got flood insurance information, and we had a lot of questions about flood insurance, and that is an issue we should probably delve more into, especially as the snow melts. So this green folder is from the Department of Commerce, and let's see. I don't think, was there anything else included in the packets to announce? Okay. And then what I will do is just get started. What we want to cover today is the mortgage lending foreclosure issues overview. Some of you know that over the last 4 years, in fact, Mr. Stang is going to be providing the information as our committee counsel, and I asked him just if he could do it up to the front there so that we could all see and jump in with questions and interact a little better. But I've asked him to present this information. We've passed, I believe, somewhere in the neighborhood of 27 or 28 different bills relating to foreclosures over the past 4 years. And I was told that they incorporated something like 80-some different provisions, somewhere in that ballpark. I don't know if you have a count on that, but it was a lot over the last 4 years as the foreclosure issue has unfolded before us over the last several years. So Mr. Stang is going to be talking about what it is the legislature has done over the course of the last 4 years. And then following that, we've got some folks from the real estate industry, Christine Berger and Paul Egger from the Minnesota Association of Realtors, again, not to be confused with retailers, the Realtors. And they'll be talking about the state of affairs in the real estate industry from the private sector perspective. And then Sue Basago from MLT, or the Minnesota Land Title Association, which play a role certainly in the real estate world. So that's what we have on schedule for today. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about banking, credit unions, and then we will actually have our first bill in the committee tomorrow, Senate File 125, and that is a John Carlson bill. Dealing with it's a banking issue, dealing with some branches up in his district. So he or somebody hopefully has talked to you, so you at least know a little bit about the bill. But that'll be on deck for tomorrow. So with that, do the committee members have any questions about what we're doing today or tomorrow? Then let's go ahead and proceed. Mr. Stang, if you would like to walk us through what in the world the legislature has done in the last 4 years dealing with foreclosure and lender issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm working off it should be in your packet, a document entitled Recent Mortgage Lending / Foreclosure Legislation. And it's my intention just to provide a brief recap or overview of the significant legislation in these areas that has been considered in the Commerce Committee and passed by the legislature over the last few years since the housing market collapse, which I believe started around the mid-2006 time frame. I don't think I have all 82 bills in here, Senator Gerlach, but I try to pick out the ones of major significance that I thought would be of most interest to the committee. And I'd also point out initially as a matter of jurisdiction, obviously this committee has jurisdiction over mortgage lending, mortgage banking, but we do not have primary jurisdiction over the foreclosure process. That's a Judiciary Committee issue, although historically those foreclosure bills which have major impact or significance on lenders generally do get a hearing in this committee, and we do get a look at them. And everyone I've mentioned in this presentation did get discussed and considered in this committee. The action really kicked off in 2007 with Senator Higgins' mortgage lending reform proposals, They did a number of things, including prohibiting making a mortgage loan without verifying a borrower's reasonable ability to make the payments through actual documentation. This gets to the so-called liar's loan issue that you may have heard about. You know, for example, a commission salesman whose estimate of his past and future earnings may turn out to be somewhat shaky. A lot of those loans seem to have were being made in that time frame. And now it's a matter of state law. You actually have actual documentation, such things as tax returns or payroll stubs or reasonable cash flow estimates that you can back up to make to paper your file with. It's all also prohibited is so-called refinancing of special mortgage loans, and these are loans originated or subsidized by a tribal or government entity or a nonprofit that has non-standard payment terms like the payment may vary with your income level or super low interest or forgivable principal, something like that. It's unlawful to refinance those types of mortgages. It also prohibits churning, which is defined as a mortgage loan that does not provide a reasonable, tangible net benefit to the borrower, considering all the circumstances of the loan. The committee did get some testimony that it wasn't apparent why certain loans were being refinanced. It didn't appear to be great benefit to the borrower in many of them, and other than generating fees and commissions, there didn't appear to be great benefit to the borrower. So churning is prohibited now as well. And also prohibited is negative amortization, which simply means that the payments on the loan don't even cover the interest on them. So the more you pay, the more you owe. The principal keeps going up, so that's no longer allowed either, except in the case of a reverse mortgage, which I'll touch on a little bit later, which is a kind of a special animal. Point two, the lender is also required now to inform the borrower that beyond the payment, part of your payment for principal and interest, there's also an additional amount due for property taxes and homeowners insurance, just so they're aware of, people who aren't aware of that are aware of that, and that's required to be done at the initial time that the lender comes up with an estimate of what the payment would be and every time the estimate changes. The bill established a mortgage broker duty of agency relationship with the borrower. The mortgage broker is now required to act in the borrower's best interest and in good faith. The relationship there was somewhat unclear in law prior to this bill being passed. The broker cannot accept undisclosed compensation that inures to the benefit of the broker on an expenditure made by the borrower. A borrower injured by a defined set of violations now has a private right of action against a mortgage lender, broker, or real estate appraiser under the statute, and including the possibility of recovering punitive damages and attorney's fees.
Mr. Stang, could you explain what the significance of a private right of action is?
Pardon me?
Could you explain what the significance of a private right of action, what that means,
certainly,
and what the implication is?
These amendments were made to Chapter 58 of the Code, which dealt with mortgage originators and servicers, but that's a licensing statute, or it was up to this point. And essentially, if you had a prohibited practice or something the mortgage broker or lender did wrong, it would be a licensing issue at the Commerce Department level. You could bring actions to terminate his license, discipline, fines, that kind of thing. But it didn't really provide any real remedy to a consumer, himself or herself. So this, by putting a private right of action in here, a consumer is actually allowed to sue themselves under that statutory provision rather than just rely on the Commissioner of Commerce to bring an enforcement action in terms of a license remedy. This bill also established a felony crime of residential mortgage fraud. Moving into 2008, on the foreclosure side, this bill was carried by Senator Scheid at a time when the state was seeing and continues to see, actually, a rising number of foreclosures, a foreclosure prevention counseling bill. And what this bill does is provide for notice to a borrower when foreclosure is started that counseling services are available to help the borrower understand their options, and also requires the borrower's contact information to be sent to one of these authorized foreclosure prevention counseling agencies so they can contact the borrower and try to offer assistance. This bill also requires a foreclosure advice notice to tenants, which sort of informs them about the foreclosure process. In 2009, another Senator Scheid bill, which passed through the legislature but was actually vetoed by Governor Pawlenty, was the Foreclosure Mediation Act. And what that did was to establish a good faith mediation process prior to foreclosure being allowed at the option of the borrower, and it was to be administered through the Attorney General's office. And it was sort of set up to be analogous or similar to the farmer lender mediation legislation that was passed during the farm credit crisis in the 80s, and that law was passed originally on a temporary basis, and it's been extended every several years since then. But as I mentioned, the governor did veto it. The Senate picked up another version of that bill last year and passed it again, but the House did not take it up, so it didn't even get to the governor last year.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'm not planning on reintroducing that, but I sure it's the Senate version of that last year. I think we had indications, actually, that the then-Governor Pawlenty probably would have signed it because it didn't set up a whole new structure of mediators. It relied on the current system, Bureau of Mediation Services, and administrative hearing officers. So one of his objections was the expense of setting up a whole new structure when we already had a structure in place, and Senator Olson at the time was very strongly convicted that we shouldn't be setting up anything new. So, you know, that legislation is lying there. No, it's not lying anyplace. I guess it's been eradicated. But it would have saved some homes for some people. So if anybody's interested in that version, you look up what the Senate did last year. It's considerably different from the one that the governor vetoed.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Stang.
Mr. Chairman, this one's not in your materials, but Mr. Jourovsky in the audience said, he was looking at my list and said, as long as I was including vetoed measures in my presentation, I should also mention a bill carried by Senator Anderson in 2008, which was the so-called Subprime Foreclosure Deferment Act, which allowed a borrower to defer foreclosure on certain defined subprime loans if they made 65% of the monthly payment due. And again, that law was vetoed by, not law, but that that measure was vetoed by Governor Pawlenty as well.
And Mr. Stang, that was in 2009?
2008.
That was in 2008.
Okay. Moving on to last year, the legislature passed the so-called SAFE Act, Secure and Fair. Fair is misspelled there. Apologize. Enforcement Act. That was a federally required statute. I think Minnesota was the last state to actually pass it, but it requires the Department of Commerce to license mortgage originator employees as individuals. Historically, and I think even today, the state separately licenses the business entity that employs these individuals, but it never actually licensed the human being. And the federal government required that in the wake of the housing market collapse. And this bill requires participation in a nationwide mortgaging mortgage licensing system and registry includes nationwide uniform standards and a nationwide database of individual licenses. It contains requirements for examination to become eligible to be a mortgage broker, continuing education requirements, and that sort of thing. And the registry is operated by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors.
Mr. Stang?
Yes, sir.
Do you, this is probably a question for the Department of Commerce, but maybe you know the numbers. Obviously, the number of mortgage originators over the last several years has dropped precipitously. But now that they're being licensed as individuals, do you happen to know how many the Department of Commerce is how many are licensed now?
Mr. Chair, I don't. I thought I saw Kevin Murphy here somewhere. If you'd like to take a crack at that one.
Oh, that'd be great. Just wondering what maybe the trend line is on that. Like I say, I'm sure it's dropped precipitously over the last several years, but I'm wondering if it's leveled off or who's left in the industry. Or Mr. Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, there's been a major contraction in the mortgage industry over the last several years, partly because Wall Street simply stopped buying subprime loans after catastrophic losses. So a lot of people have exited the business. So we're right in the middle of this transition to the national mortgage licensing system. And I think we have about around 400 companies that have transitioned onto the new system. And I believe there are about 2,200 human beings that have been licensed. And there's about 500 human beings who are sort of in limbo because they haven't either passed the test or completed the education requirements. So the industry has shrunk considerably over the last several years for a variety of factors, including the new SAFE Act requirements probably.
Okay, and Mr. Murphy, so since this is an occupational licensure, so the individual licensees, these mortgage originators, the humans, beings that are licensed, with the licensing requirement, there is, what does it take to become licensed? There is an examination. There's probably some sort of a filing fee of some sort, or what are the requirements for an individual to be a licensed mortgage originator today?
I can't remember the exact amount of the licensing fee, but that's paid to this national mortgage licensing system. There is a fingerprinting background check requirement. There are lifetime prohibitions against somebody who's been convicted of a financial crime. They have to pass both a state and a federal test, and there's a continuing education requirement that needs to be satisfied. So it's a fairly stringent screening standard, and of course before we didn't license the human beings, we required the companies to look after the people that they were employing, which didn't always work as well as we had hoped.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Gazalka.
So if I can ask then, so is the net result helping the consumer or hurting them? I realize that we had people that didn't do loans properly, but I'm guessing there was a number of people that just didn't want the extra requirement and dropped out. Would you say that, so what's your perspective on that as far as whether we got less people out there helping the consumer or more?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, a very complicated question. There was a bipartisan commission in Washington that studied the financial meltdown. They wrote a report that was around 600 pages with a lot of dissension, so it'd be very hard to put your finger on the exact nature of the problem in this short of a forum. But I think the big change took place when Wall Street simply stopped buying subprime loans, and then the merry-go-round stopped, and a lot of people had to get off. So a lot of people got out of the business because there was nobody that would buy the loans that they were trying to generate. And a lot of the mortgage business has gone back into the banking business, where it kind of started out at many years ago. So I would say it's pretty clear that there are a lot less people in that business currently, but hopefully those that are in there are more legitimate, better trained, and better prepared to serve the consumer than previously.
As long as Deputy Commissioner Murphy is there. Does anybody have any questions for him?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Dames.
I do have a question on, we were talking about the private right of action against the mortgage in Alaska, now that both of you are up here. Do you have any idea how many people have chose that route to take action against their lending institution, or do you have any idea what the results of that have been since this has been in force?
Mr. Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, no, I have no idea how many.
Is there some way we can get
Senator
that information?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I can't think of any way right off the top of my head.
All right. Thank you very much. And for the record, this is Deputy Commissioner Kevin Murphy from the Department of Commerce. Then, Mr. Stang, if you want to continue on.
Thanks.
I believe we're down to Chapter 375 that passed last year. That bill was, again, authored by Senator Scheid. Senator Terrell Clark was responsible for the reverse mortgage provisions that ended up in that bill. I think most of you are probably aware of what a reverse mortgage is, but very simply, it's usually when an elderly person is able to tap into their home equity through a loan that is not required to be repaid until the home is sold, which is oftentimes when the person might go into a nursing home or when they die. So it's a little bit different kind of a product. And they can either receive their funding on a monthly basis or get lump sum up front. But Senator Clark believed there was a need for some enhanced regulatory requirements for those type of loans. And several of them ended up in this bill, including enhanced counseling requirements, which requires at least 60 minutes of counseling to the person in certain statutorily defined areas. The bill contains a 7-day cooling off period where the borrower is not bound for 7 days after the borrower accepts the lender's written commitment to make the loan, and the borrower can't be required to close during that time period. And thirdly, third major provision was that a lender could not require a purchase of an annuity, investment product, or insurance product as a condition of obtaining a reverse mortgage loan or receive compensation for providing the borrower with information relating to such a product. It's felt perhaps that elderly people are vulnerable to sales pressure for these kinds of products at that time because they have money in hand. The foreclosure provisions of this bill dealt with really explaining or requiring more notice to the borrower in terms of their redemption rights during the foreclosure process, and it explains to the borrower what their options are during the redemption period, which occurs after the sheriff's sale and is generally a 6-month period, during which time you have the right to redeem your home in foreclosure. And the notice tells you such things as the redemption amount may be less than the amount owed on the mortgage before the sale. It's the amount that was the property was sold for at the sheriff's sale, which might be less than the mortgage balance at that time. And you also have the ability to sell your house during that period if you can generate the funds to cover the amount that it was sold for at the sheriff's sale and other liens and claims against the property. It also requires a notice of the actual result of the sheriff's sale to the borrower by any person who is attempting to acquire fee title directly from the borrower during the redemption period. So they have to give such things as the sale price, the date, the name of the purchaser, and so forth. So at least the borrower is aware of what the property sold for at the sheriff's sale. And again, a private right of action is provided here against someone who fails to provide that notice to the borrower. So, Mr. Chairman, that's okay. kind of a recap of at least what I thought was the major legislation, mortgage lending and foreclosure, that this committee has considered over the last few years.
Okay. All right. Do any members have any questions on what was done in the last few years? Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a real quick question about the churning provision in the 2007 legislation. Just for an example, say you have some folks that are in an ARM. That ARM is coming due. It's apparent that they're not going to be able to get back in it. Would a lender be able to put them into an identical ARM? Because I know that you're saying there has to be a net benefit. Is that extension of time considered a net benefit, or would it have to be a fixed mortgage that they were moved into to qualify?
That's an interesting question. Again, these are subject to judicial gloss over time in terms of construing them. But the purpose of the law was to, at least taking in all the facts and circumstances of a loan, it had to have some sort of benefit to the borrower. And in your case, an ARM which is running out, if they don't refinance into something else, they're going to be kicked out of their home. So that's a pretty big tangible benefit right there. So I think in that case, you would have some leeway to look at those kinds of products. But in general, what the testimony of the committee heard and what raised concern was certain refinancing where you just couldn't, under any set of circumstances, see any benefit to the borrower at all of doing the transaction. But in your situation, I think you could structure one that a benefit, and that benefit primarily being a borrower and able to stay in the house.
Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, then I'm saying if you want to come back then, and I would encourage members to hold on to this outline, because I can tell you that undoubtedly you will get calls and letters from constituents in your districts with very difficult situations, and some of this might at least point you in the right direction of where some answers might be for them. So I think that this is very, very beneficial. So thank you very much, Mr. Stang, for your presentation. Let's go ahead and move into the real estate overview. And this would be some folks from the private sector, the industry, the real estate industry. And why don't you come on up and introduce your names and organizations that you represent for the record. And then it looks like you have a PowerPoint prepared for us. And I look like we've got a handout in your packets as well. And I will turn this over to you for our real estate presentation.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Paul Egger with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And with me is Christine Berger, also with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And we really appreciate the opportunity to be with you today. Just a little bit about our association for those of you that may not be familiar. The Minnesota Association of Realtors is the largest business trade association in the state, representing approximately 20,000 realtors throughout Minnesota. And members, realtors are real estate licensees, but not all licensees are realtors, because we have the code of ethics that applies to realtors. So our members do abide by a code of ethics. The association represents our membership in a variety of ways, one of which is what we're doing today is governmental affairs. We also represent our members in terms of professional standards, forms development, assistance with legal opinions, and, of course, education. So, Mr. Chair, we do have a little bit of a transition happening at the association. We've had an opportunity to meet with most of the members of the committee, and those of you that we haven't had an opportunity to meet with yet, we're on your schedules. But Christine has been our face at the Capitol for the last several years, and she is expecting. And so we're transitioning to a new team of Kate Johansson-Justman and me taking over for Christine. But we're happy to say Christine is staying with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. She'll be coming back to a different role with us after her maternity leave. So I, for one, am very thankful that she's still around and able to help with the transition, in particular to be here today and share the duties on the housing market overview. The chairman mentioned your packets, and we have provided to each of you some customized data that represents the regional housing market data that includes your Senate district. And Christine is going to be covering the statewide data, but we thought you would be interested in data for your specific part of the state. If you are interested in the full packet of information that includes all the regions as well as the statewide, please don't hesitate to let us know, and we'll make sure to get the full packet of information to you. So after Christine covers the market data, we're going to provide a little bit of context to what those numbers mean. You're going to see a lot of charts and graphs, and we'll try to do a little bit of interpretation for you in terms of what it's telling us about the market. And with that, I'll turn it over to Christine. Oh, I'm sorry. One of the, just back to the customized data you have in your packets, this map shows the breakdown of regions. For the most part, it's by regional development organization boundaries. So we don't have Senate district specific data. So what we did is we provided the data by region that includes your Senate district.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christine Berger. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And thank you for the opportunity for allowing us to present today. Before we dive into the data, I just want to talk a little bit about, just reiterate what Paul said, that this is a statewide analysis, what you'll be seeing in the PowerPoint, and it's on residential housing, which of course includes single-family homes, condos, and townhomes. And we get this data from our multiple listing services from all over the state, and these graphs were compiled for us by one of our local boards. And then just a word about the format of these graphs so you're able to clearly understand what's being presented to you today. On the upper left-hand side, you'll see three bars that indicate for the month of December a three-year comparison. So from left to right, you'll see data for December 2008, December 2009, and December 2010. On the right-hand side, you'll see annual figures for 2008, 9, and 10 moving across the chart. And then at the bottom, there will always be a nice little recent history showing you some of the trends in real estate for the indicator. Well, we'll start off with new listings, which is always, of course, the beginning of the real estate transaction. And a new listing is simply a seller decides to put their home on the market, and they contact a realtor, and they start working with the realtor, and the property gets listed into the multiple listing service, and it's on the market. And we track these just to see how many people are putting their homes up on the market for sale every month and then over the year. So you'll see for in the third bar, you'll see that the December new listings equaled approximately 7,000 new listings just in the month of December of 2010. And on the far right, you'll see for the total year for 2010, it was 150,000 new listings in 2010. Which is up only about 1% from 2009. So 150,000 people or properties went onto the market in 2010. At the bottom, you'll see the most recent history. It goes back to January of 2004, so it does include some of the real estate boom years in there. And you can see how very cyclical the real estate market is, with the peaks occurring in the summer where we have the most activity, people deciding to put their homes on the market during the summer, and kind of dropping off in the cold winter months.
Ms. Berger, I have a question. I'm just curious now. Obviously, weather has something to do with that when people want to hoof couches through doorways and such. But would you see a similar cycle in other states, say southern states? Would Texas or Arizona have a similar cycle? Or is their real estate listing cycle more flat and consistent throughout the year? I don't know if you have an answer to that. It just occurred to me. I'm just curious if this is unique to Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, members, I would say that this is not unique because I think school years also play a role. And, you know, kids, parents don't want to move their kids in the middle of the school year, or they try not to, or they may try to, you know, wait until things slow down in the summer. Well, it slows down in the summer for some people. But anyway, I think this trend would be carried out maybe to a lesser extent in some of the warmer climates, but I think school factors in with it as well. So moving a little bit further on into the transaction, we have pending sales. And pending sales for the month of December in 2010 equaled just under 5,000. So we had, let me define what a pending sale is. We had 5,000 pending sales. A pending sale is where an offer has been made and accepted on a property, and a purchase agreement has been signed, but we have not yet gone to the closing table. And a lot of realtors jokingly call this purgatory because you're kind of in that in waiting. Anyway, so 5,000, just under 5,000 in 2010, which was an increase over 2009 of nearly 20%. And the total pending sales for 2010 equaled 66,500. So at some stage throughout the year, those 66,500 transactions went into the pending status. Down below, once again, you can see historical trends. Going back to January of 2004, there's a point there for every single month going forward, showing it once again how very cyclical the real estate market is. And then at the end of the transaction, we have what's called closed sales, and this is literally a done deal. This is when people leave the closing table. And in the month of December, we had 5,000 closed sales just in that one month alone. And for the year, we had 65,800 closed sales in 2010, which is unfortunately down from 2009. It was about an 11% drop from 2009 in the number of closed sales we had in 2010. So once again, at the bottom, historical closed sales going back to January of 2004. And once again, you'll see the historical or the cyclical pattern repeats. Once the sale is completed, we calculate what's called days on market. And this is just how long did it take for the property to sell. And it's an average figure. So on average, in the month of December, it took 118 days until those properties closed. For the entire year in 2010, on the far right side, it took 123 days, which is about 4 months. You can see it about the spring of January of 2008, it did peak to about 5 months on the market until the property was sold. And I can tell you, this graph only goes back to January of 2007, but I can tell you during the kind of the big real estate boom periods of 2005 and 2006, properties were selling at about, the days on market was about 2 months. So that going from the initial new listing until the date of closing was just 2 months. So now we're at 4 months. It had peaked to five months, so a little bit of improvement there. One thing I will point out is that the days on market is decreasing, which is a good sign. And this is a chart that everyone wants to know about. What are the prices doing? This is the median sales price. And you probably remember from your statistics class, the median, if you were to sort all of the sales transactions based on their value, based on their sales price, and take that middle value, so there'd be an equal number of transactions or sales prices above them and an equal number of transactions below them, and you take that middle sales price, that's the median. And for December, the median sales price was $136,000, but for the entire year, the median sales price was $150,000. And this is, interestingly enough, unchanged from 2009. We also track how much the seller received as a percent of the original list price, and I'll define this by giving you a hypothetical. For example, if I put my house in the market for $100,000 and Paul makes an offer for $90,000 and I accept his offer of $90,000, my original list price was $100,000. I have accepted $90,000. That's 90% of my original list price of $100,000. So in December, it was just under 90%. In 2010, but and then you'll see for the average in the 2010, it was about 91%, and historically you'll see it stayed within that 90 to 100% region with just a few exceptions where it's dropped down below. Oh, one thing I will point out: if you are, you see a little bit of the cyclical nature here. And it looks like you get the most bang for the buck if you're a seller in the summer, and if you're a buyer, you want to buy in the off seasons. So just a little note for your memory. And then inventory of homes available. This one we do not track on an annual basis. We just do it monthly because as homes sell, they move off the inventory, and so there's no point in tracking them anymore. But this is just for the month of December, and unfortunately, the the person who made this graphic kind of cut off at the top, but you can see that we do have a significant inventory. We have 60,000 homes available just in the month of December, and that is a slight drop, almost 13% drop in what it was in 2009. But you can see really from January of 2004 how that inventory has continuously just climbed and climbed, but now we're starting to drop back off. But that's kind of the seasonal drop as well, so we'll see how that moves forward. So those are kind of...
I'm sorry, Senator Sparks has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Berger. On that last slide, your inventory of homes available, would that include new construction as well, or is that just existing stock that's...
Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks, I believe the information is just on existing properties. So we get asked a lot, what are some of the factors impacting the real estate economy and the recovery? I think, you know, and clearly there are several factors, but we just picked out a few here for the committee's review. One of them, clearly, the unemployment situation, the unemployment level. We have a lower rate than the national unemployment rate. Ours is 7% as in December of 2010, and the national rate is 9.1, so we are better than the national rate, but... you know, people are still worried about the risk of losing their job, or they have lost their job. And, of course, no one's going to buy a home if they don't have a job. So that's obviously impacting the real estate recovery. Consumer confidence is another one. People are nervous, as I just mentioned, and so consumer confidence has really been shaken. And consumer expenditures is really, you know, a huge part of our economy and will play a huge role in our recovery. Personal expenditures is tied to it's 70% of our gross domestic product, and so it has a huge role in our economy and the recovery. The good news is that personal consumption expenditures is expected to grow in 2011 by over 4%, and we haven't seen that rate of growth for 11 years. So that we've hopefully got some good news going forward for 2011. Credit availability, we're hearing from our realtors that it's still difficult for our buyers, our clients, to get mortgages. It's credit has contracted. As you saw earlier, inventory and foreclosures are still a problem. We still have a lot of inventory out there. Just in the month of December, we had 60,000 homes available for sale. So good time to buy. You've got a lot of great choices. And the foreclosure problem hasn't really let up yet either. So we've got those issues kind of impacting the recovery. But two points of good news. We've got very low interest rates. Interest rates, of course, for mortgages are tied to the federal funds rate, and that has been set at a range by the Fed since December of 2008 at a range between 0.25% and 0%, and so that obviously has a big impact on the long-term mortgage rate. So that's good news. And then, of course, people are saving more, so the savings rate is up, and that's good news because people will have more money to make a down payment, they'll have more skin in the game, and more equity hopefully going forward.
Well, and Mr. Chair, one of the questions to ask, as well, is the glass half empty or half full? And we'll give you a diplomatic answer. It's both. If you look at the – we'll try to end on a high note, so we'll start with the glass being half empty. Closed sales are down, as Christine mentioned. And so that, you know, certainly is a key indicator of the health of the housing market, and it's disappointing that the closed sales figures are down. You heard a common theme, I think, throughout the presentation in that inventory is a problem. And the inventory of homes, although it has dropped slightly, it's still very significant. And that factors into the law of supply and demand. And there's just a lot of supply on the market at this point. And lastly, new listings are up. And that could be due to a variety of figures. For one, it could be the unemployment rate, as Christine just mentioned. Although Minnesota's rate is below the national average, there's still a significant number of people that are out of work, and that's certainly going to impact the housing market in real substantial ways. And the other factor to consider in terms of new listings was part of the figure could be attributed to homeowners finding themselves in tough times because of the economy, and trying to sell their home before they find themselves in foreclosure. So those are a couple of the factors to consider in the new listings. Now, there is reason for optimism, too. So the glass is certainly half full in many respects. New listings are up, and that can be a good thing as well. It means that consumer confidence is returning, and the people are homeowners are confident that if they put their house on the market, they'll be able to sell it and move into another property. The days on the market is dropping, and that's very good news. That'll ultimately lead to the inventory shrinking and supply and demand being more in balance. And again, back to the inventory. It's inventory, inventory, inventory in terms of looking at the health of the housing market. And the inventory of properties, although it's still extremely high when you look at historical data, particularly if you go back to kind of the housing boom years, it is dropping slightly. So there is reason for optimism in, I think, what are some very challenging figures for the overall housing market. And with that, Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to take any questions.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know who would want to respond to this. I'd be interested to hear from either one of you. You listed as one of the issues credit availability. And one of the things I've observed that's just incredible is, you know, 5 years ago, if you had a discernible pulse, you could get a loan for 100% of your inflated home value, right? Now we're in a situation where the stories are legion of extremely creditworthy people that seemingly can't get loans. How much of that problem is the result of federal regulation and things that the federal government are doing that we have limited control over? How much of that is state law involved that we might be able to help you with, and do you have any suggestions on it?
Mr. Egger.
I'll defer to Christine on this one. She has a little bit more experience on the mm-hmm. on the issue.
Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, that's a great question. I think there are several factors. I think one of it may be due to the federal regulations. Definitely, Congress has acted in a number of ways since this whole crisis kind of broke out. I think the other factor is, of course, how much risk do the lenders themselves want to take on? They're obviously being more cautious. And so I think it's not just federal regulation, but also just, you know, the business sense of how much risk do I want to take on or potentially then sell off to on the secondary market. So much of the banking regulations are handled on a federal level. I'd have to think more about what the state could do. But I think it's a kind of a mix of factors involved in the credit availability factor.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, I believe you're having your next overview on the banking industry, and I know Deputy Commissioner Murphy is here, and that would actually be probably a great question for Commerce to weigh in on, kind of what has been the impact of the tightening of credit availability compared to, as you put it, just having a discernible pulse a few years ago.
Other questions, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to echo Senator Thompson's comments. That is what I hear most about, you know, as you talk about the low interest rates. It's exceedingly frustrating for people not to be able to access those low interest rates because of the change in equity in their homes and therefore the ratio. And I hear the reason being given as to the federal regulations, but I think that your brief comment when you mentioned the selling the mortgages into the secondary market, you know, this mortgage business has turned into an investment strategy for people to make money on, which is very different than when people buy their homes. That's not their intention as they get that mortgage. They don't really have, first and foremost in their minds, hoping that somebody makes money on them later down the chain. And so I would ask you to give serious consideration to if there's anything we can do it as a state. And I'm not very optimistic about that, but I think it's a real issue for the people of Minnesota.
Okay. I have a question. I'm actually trying to sort out which of my questions I are for the bankers for tomorrow on the finance side of things and which ones that would be appropriate that you could answer for us. Let me ask you this. Since you represent the agents that are out in the field doing the sales, and for full disclosure, I actually had a real estate license for a number of years. I don't now, but I did for a number of years. And it's a completely different world than when it was when I did that. But my question is about short sales. A few years back, that was a very unusual animal for someone to be in a short sale situation. Now it's a very regular occurrence, and agents on a regular basis have to be educated and know how to deal with short sales. How can you tell me a little bit about, maybe you could explain, because that is so prevalent now, what exactly a short sale is, how that's affecting things in your industry with the agents, and how are you dealing with that, maybe with some continuing ed, or where's that going with that, and what is the trend line for short sales, maybe where it's been the last couple of years, and where you think is it leveling off, or where are we at with that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, wow. Yes, short sales are prevalent in our real estate market. A short sale is when, let's say, for example, I have a mortgage on my property, hypothetically speaking, for $200,000, and the market just won't get me there. So, you know, Paul's willing to make an offer of $185,000, and then I have to go to my lender and ask them, will you accept $185,000 for this property instead of the $200,000? And so when that's approved by the lender and by the seller, then it's called a short sale. And they're becoming very common because of the drop in market values that we've seen where people are just losing equity in general. So what is the industry doing? Well, we have held several courses for our brokers and for our agents on the rules and regulations and standards of practice and just kind of good guidance on how to deal with short sales and working with lenders to facilitate that, to get them moving along faster, because that's an issue as well. So we do try to educate our members on those issues. The trend line, I can tell you, I just looked up before I came to the committee, that there were, in December, there were 288 short sales in the Twin Cities, just in the month of December, and which was consisted of 11% of the real estate market of the closed sales in the Twin Cities. The number of foreclosed sales or lender-owned sales was about 37% of the total sales in the Twin Cities in December. So it's a chunk of the sales, and it's prevalent. But yes, we're working with, you know, how to deal with the lenders during this time frame, how to keep our buyers. It's a lengthy time frame, how to work with our, you know, keep the buyers still interested in the property so they don't walk away, have the seller maintain their patience, et cetera, et cetera. So I hope that answers your question.
Sure, if I could ask a follow-up on that, because you did allude to it, but I hear anecdotally that one of the biggest problems with closing short sales is the lender approval, that seems to take an enormous amount of time, and it seems to sort of go in a black hole where they don't get answers from the lender about approving the short sale, and they're just looking for decisions. Now, I'll ask this question tomorrow, if I don't remind me, but because I do want to get at that, because that speeding the process on these transactions is important, and I've never got an answer about what goes into that decision-making process from the lender side. Why is it taking so long? But is that you must be hearing the same thing, because you alluded to it or you mentioned it, that approval process. But what can you tell me about that, or what can we do to help in something like that?
Mr. Chair, what I would say about that, we are hearing from our members that it does take a long time to get a short sale approved, but I think of it this way, that the lenders have to approve taking a hit. So they had a $200,000 mortgage, now they have to take a hit of, you know, Paul's only going to pay $185,000. So I'll let them answer, I'll let the lenders and bankers answer what goes into the approval process. But yes, I am hearing that from the agents, and I imagine there are several factors involved, such as them taking a hit.
Okay. Senator Cruz, and then.
Yeah, I just actually, thank you, Mr. Chairman, maybe I can offer a little bit of support. First of all, Christine, thank you for all you've done. For full disclosure, I do currently have a real estate license, and I just want to say thank you for your service and everything that you've done for us, and congratulations. So secondly, kind of to a couple of the points that you made, I have done a considerable amount of short sales in my real estate career, and I can tell you, to answer your first point, is there education out there as far as short sales go? I would say yes, there is, and I think what you're finding among realtors is those who want to survive in this market are taking advantage of that on their own without being regulated too, just because it is such a prevalent part of our market right now. A couple other things that I would, you know, just like to offer up. I think that, and you can agree with me or disagree with me, I think short sales are beneficial to the market right now in its current condition. And here's why I think that. I think that if a property goes into full foreclosure and is put on the bank to turn it around and sell it, you have an extended time where that home is probably not occupied, maybe not being taken care of, and you see a deterioration in the housing market when stuff like that happens. I think the advantage that we can provide through short sales is getting these properties off of the bank's books as soon as possible. So if you can potentially get an offer for one of these properties without having it go all the way into full foreclosure, it's pretty beneficial to almost everybody involved. And then kind of, you know, what are some of the hindrances to that? I think you hit on it exactly. There is a difficulty in getting responses from banks. I think that's for a couple of different reasons. A, I think that's because there's such a sheer amount of volume that they're dealing with right now. It's just tough wading through it. A lot of what I've heard is also, Christine touched on this, but essentially what happens is these mortgages get sold off to a secondary market, and they get broken up into different funds and different financial vehicles, if you will. In order to complete some of this paperwork for the banks, that has to all be collected again. And the investors, the original investors, have to agree on this short sale. And so that takes a considerable amount of time. So I think those are a couple of factors. What is the answer to that? How do you make that quicker? I mean, I'd love to have that conversation off the top of my head. I don't see any way to do it. You're dealing with legal contracts and people who are investors and need to be, you know, communicated with. They have a stake in whatever the property is. So I guess I would just kind of offer up some of that.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another less common but also used tool in this new arena is a short refi, where you can refinance but not at the full amount. But the thing I would point to on both of those is it really destroys a person's credit history. So I think the consumer may think that, oh, this is a panacea to do a short sale and get out of this mess, but they may not realize that then their credit rating would be significantly lowered. So if you have any comments about that.
Well, on your, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonoff, on your first point, certainly the short refi scenario is a probably a good discussion to have with the lenders when they're before the committee. But I think you know your point is well taken on the hit to a consumer's credit. It's certainly, and I think Senator Cruz, you made several good points, and I'll tie it back to the data that Christine shared. I think it was 30. What was the number, Christine? 30-some% of sales in the Twin Cities were foreclosures. I mean, we're seeing a volume for the lenders. To be fair to them, that they probably have never dealt with before in terms of looking at their balance sheets and seeing a reduction rather than the homeowner seeing an increase in their equity and the lender seeing at least properties being sold for what they equal on the balance sheet. So it's a very tough environment. We're not out of the woods yet, and the challenges are significant, and a lot of good discussion around the table, a lot of good questions, and there's a lot of overlap, and Mr. Chairman and members of the committee have pointed it out, between the presentation here today and the discussion I think you're going to have in the next committee.
Okay. And Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Ager, Ms. Berger, thanks for being here. The complaint, I guess I'm hearing more often than other things, and for full disclosure, I owned a real estate and building company for many years. So,
Mr. Chairman, maybe we should ask who didn't.
And oh, by the way, I ran governmental affairs for the North Metro Realtors for a number of years as well. So very involved in the market. And the thing I'm hearing today is appraisal issues that, you know, in the old days, so to speak, you couldn't compare an appraisal of a foreclosed property in a neighborhood to a house that had a willing buyer and a willing seller. They were supposed to set the values in the market, and yet with the prevalence of 30-some percent of the foreclosures, what I'm hearing from people that do want to actually go out and buy a house from somebody, they're saying, well, I'd rather buy it that has an occupant because the house is in nicer shape, that the grounds have been kept up, and all those little things that may or may not happen in a foreclosure situation. But I'm really hearing that the appraisal market's very mucked up. Could you comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, when a realtor does their comps, so they'll go into the multiple listing service and find similar properties in the area that have like number of bedrooms, like number of garage stalls, et cetera, et cetera. Some of those foreclosures may fall into that, into the comps. If it's a comparable sale in the neighborhood, they may fall into that, which of course would bring down the market value of the property that I may be trying to sell. I believe that in the tax valuations that foreclosures are not allowed to be evaluated in that mix. So I think in the real estate market we do use them, but in the tax appraisals for local governments they're not used, is my understanding.
Okay. Follow up? Okay. And Senator Jungbauer, just if you tell us about any of your previous occupations or ventures, you won't surprise us. You told us that you repaired pianos in Kazakhstan, and I wouldn't doubt it at all for a minute. I would take it as fact. So,
Chair and members, that would be septics in Poland, Germany.
I'm sure of it.
Yes.
So, okay. Well, members, if there's no further questions for our real estate folks, then thank you very much for your presentation. It's fascinating to keep up on what's happening in the marketplace. And we have another item. Last on our schedule is Sue Besego from the Minnesota Land Title Association. If you want to come up and maybe formally introduce yourself and tell us about your organization and how you fit in to this and how our committee impacts what you do as well. So welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Sue Besego, and I'm with the Minnesota Land Title Association. Unfortunately, or fortunately for us, I think, we're not quite as exciting as the realtors are or as the mortgage brokers industry are. We're the end result. When people buy a home and get a loan, we do the closings. That's what our industry does. We are a small association of underwriters, of agents, of attorneys that work with that industry as I am. We provide a voice for that industry. We are present behind the scenes a lot of times working on legislation that affects recordings, that affects how mortgages are dealt with. We kind of work jointly with a lot of the different associations that you will be hearing from. And in fact, our industry is licensed under the Department of Commerce. Our underwriters, one of the things that we were asked to do is give an overview of some of the statutes that affect us. 60A is the general insurance provisions that you will deal with on some of the issues that you'll see before you. 68A deals specifically with title insurance in companies. 60K is for the insurance producers, so those that are agents and individual, some of the closers that are individual selling the insurance will be licensed under that. And then, of course, we do have come under the category of 82, which deals with real estate agents and salespersons, but we also have some items that we deal with under that deal with table funding, that deal with trust account issues, that deal with compensation, and then that we actually have to close a loan either off of a title commitment or attorney's opinion. So those are some of the regulations that we deal with on a daily basis in the industry. And, of course, we are also regulated by the federal government through the RESPA, and we do have to follow guidelines through RESPA that we follow through what the lenders provide to us. So those are the types of things that you will see before you. We've worked in the past with the Realtors Association on a number of different issues. Most notably, they carried a bill on private transfer fees, so we do work with them. I think Marty Henschel from our organization has been before you a number of times testifying. We would like to be a resource to the committee that we can provide information on the industry. We talk about the short sale closings. We certainly see that from our end, making sure that we follow the compliances that the lenders request at the time of closing, make sure that the title is clear, that all those issues that lead up to that, that the consumer and the end gets a final product, that they will actually own their home. Those are the types of things that our industry does. And so we'd like to be a resource. That's what we typically try to do, is to be there to answer your questions.
Okay. I have a question. You mentioned RESPA, so some committee members may not know what that is. Maybe you could explain what that is and how the how much of your industry is regulated by federal rules versus state rules and how that fits in.
Okay. It's the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act. I always have to look it up because we use acronyms so much in our industry that I wanted to make sure that you understood what the actual title was. Basically, that means is that we have to follow certain requirements on closing statements. The HUD-1, if anyone has closed a home, we'll see the HUD-1. As you might recall, last year we had major changes in the industry where we had to group, a lot of you are real estate agents, where we had to actually group our title services fee into one bundled fee to let the consumer be able to shop around and be able to compare pricing a lot easier. It was the understanding that the federal government wanted to make sure that everybody was on the same page when it came to title fees. We follow those rules. We also follow what the lenders have to follow under RESPA, under the Truth in Lending guidelines. We have to follow their guidelines to make sure that the consumer and everything that they're getting, it flows through, that the laws are followed correctly, that disclosures are done. And our industry typically follows those instructions as much as we can, and we always are there as a resource for those lenders as well.
Any questions? Well, it was appropriate that we had the closer to do the closing. But I will say, you've bought your house, when you go to the table, the person that puts all those papers in front of you and says, sign here, and you flip them over, that's...
It's not the most exciting industry in the world, I know that, but we certainly are there for
I will tell you what a critical process. Role that is when the agents, like Senator Cruz or whoever, are out there doing these deals and these sales, and then when they've got all the papers pulled together, it's you who actually sort that out and cross the T's and dot the I's and make sure that, like as you said, that the title of that ownership is transferred properly from one party to the next, which is it's the basis for free market economics.
That's correct.
Getting that done. So, okay. Well, then with that, members, if there's nothing else, we're going to finish early today. I appreciate your patience, and then tomorrow. We are going to be talking to the banking industry. They're actually going to be talking to you individually in your offices today because I believe it's their day on the Hill today. But we'll see them in committee and also the credit unions. And then, as I mentioned at the beginning of the hour, we've got a bill on the calendar. Senate File 125 will be heard tomorrow. So thank you, members, and the committee is adjourned.
We have session.